I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. How would you like to receive a monthly check regardless of your income with no strings attached for the rest of your life? I'm referring to something called Universal Basic Income, or UBI. It's an idea that's been around for a while and is being tried on a small scale in Finland. 2,000 people who have been unemployed and getting about $500 a month will get to keep it even after they get a job. In 2 years, researchers will see if the payment encouraged them to work or not, or something else. UBI has its supporters and its detractors, and it raises a lot of questions. Would it reduce income inequality by giving everyone a basic standard of living? Would it free people up to follow their passions? Would it address a job shortage as more work becomes automated? Would it make people lazy? Would it hurt the economy, help the economy? Would it be too expensive? As I said, lots of questions. Joining us is Scott Santons. He's a New Orleans-based writer who has been studying and championing the adoption of basic income policies and processes, and his work has been published in the Huffington Post, TechCrunch, and the Boston Globe. And Scott Santons, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Josh Barrow. He's senior editor at Business Insider. He's a contributor to MSNBC, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center, host of the Hard Pass podcast. And Josh Barrow, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
Scott, and to you, Josh, as well, we posted yesterday on Facebook that this is what the show was going to be about. And I have to say, we got a big response and a lot of questions. Scott, what is the appeal of UBI?
Well, I believe the appeal right now especially is growing from a few things. For one, people are really getting concerned about the potential rise of automation. And people, of course, are arguing if that's going to be a problem as far as just how many jobs will be eliminated in the years ahead. But we really are reading headlines now about, you know, self-driving cars, self-driving trucks, artificial intelligences that can replace even, you know, lawyers and doctors. And we're also seeing this, you know, we're in this post-Great Recession world, too, where, you know, there's just been a rise of inequality, and there's just been this transformation of the labor markets. There's just rising insecurity. And even stuff like the success of Brexit and the success of Trump, there's just a lot of unknowns and a lot of instability and a lot of insecurity growing, and people are seeing this as like, well, if this is if we're looking at kind of a transformed labor market kind of world, what are we going to do about this? And universal basic income is something that just seems to make a lot of sense because you can really transform the way that we go about our existing programs, and you can actually enable so many things based on, you know, the experiments that we've seen. There's just a lot of potential in this if you look at the evidence for the effects of cash. And it's also something that...
Well, you know what, Scott? Hold on. Hold on. Only because I want to get Josh Barrow in on the conversation, and I do want to get into some of the details. One of the things that you wrote in Business Insider, Josh, is, I have been UBI curious in the past, but you have turned against this idea. Why?
Well, I think one thing we've seen from Brexit and Donald Trump's election is that a post-work future would be very ugly. I think a big driver of the political movements we've seen over the last couple of years is people feel like the system is breaking down and work isn't working for them in the way that it used to. But what they want is for work to work again. You've seen Donald Trump go around with a, you know, jobs, jobs, and more jobs message. This, you know, this sort of, you can call what he did at the Carrier plant in Indiana a publicity stunt, but it clearly gets at that what people want is to be able to work for a living and support themselves. I think you see a lot of social resentments around the idea that, you know, I work harder and it's yet more difficult to support my family, and then my tax dollars to go to support somebody else who isn't working at all or who's working less than me. And so to the extent that a UBI is something that helps us adjust to a post-work future, makes it more possible for people to support themselves without working or without complete participation in the workforce, I think that's likely to make people angrier, less supportive of government expenditure, and to make society more unstable. I think it's not time to declare defeat against automation. You know, the biggest automation shift we went through in our economy was 150 years ago with mechanization of agriculture. People found new things to do for work. I don't think we have to say that because of driverless cars, nobody's going to be able to work for a living 50 years in the future. I think we need to find ways to employ people, to make employment satisfying and rewarding financially and also spiritually for people, rather than trying to build our society around the idea that a lot of people just won't work at all.
Josh, let me pick up on the resentment idea, and I guess the resentment that some people have that some people are getting aid to families for dependent children or they're getting food stamps. But if it's a universal, if everyone gets it, including rich people, wouldn't that take away the resentment?
Well, to some extent. But on the other hand, the program would be extremely expensive. So you'd have to have a significant tax levied on all sorts of people. And so a lot of people who work would perceive themselves to be net losers in the program. And one problem with the universality is that you get it even if you don't work. The government programs that seem to enjoy the broadest popular support are things like Social Security and Medicare, which have a great deal of universality, but also they require you to work for a certain number of years to qualify for them. And so people perceive them as earned benefits that, you know, I spent my time in the workforce, I paid my taxes in, and now I collect the benefit. You could do something that was nearly universal. For example, you could eliminate payroll tax on the first, you know, on income under the poverty line, the first $11,500 or so. That would give a benefit to any that would be equal to anybody who worked and earned at least $11,000 in the year, which would be almost everybody in the workforce. But it would make the benefit contingent on work, and it would say to people that you had to contribute something in order to get the benefit rather than giving it to everyone.
Scott, let me go back to you. And there is the question of cost. And I guess if you're talking about a universal basic income, are you talking about an income that someone could actually live on or something that gets close to that? What kind of money are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, the way I look at this is just using the current federal poverty line in the U.S., which is $11,880. So I talk about a base income of $1,000 a month. Now, you can go a little bit under that. You can go a little bit over that. People usually talk around that range because that is the way that we currently define the federal poverty line. So if we gave everybody $1,000 a month, then we do effectively abolish poverty in the U.S. with a stroke of the pen. Now, that is something, too, that people go, oh, well, wait a second, you can't just eliminate poverty with cash. And the thing is that we can. What we do is we see that when people are given cash, that they actually use it very wisely. People use it on food and people use it on healthier food. Another thing, too, is that the World Bank just looked at this recently, and people actually use slightly less alcohol and tobacco even. Like, there's a reduction and not an increase. Now, I just want to go quickly to what Josh said about work. And is that this is actually a pro-work policy. Like, when we talk about the future of work, I think that's kind of it confuses people because it's not we're not looking at a world of less work. We're looking at a world of less jobs. And so that's what we need to look at. Like, the way that we get paid to do work is changing and has been changing for decades. And the reason Finland is looking at this, actually, is because they think that providing this will actually incentivize work. Because the thing is, and this is true with all existing safety nets, is that when you are receiving a benefit and you're on welfare of some kind or unemployment or whatever, and you start earning income in the labor market, then that gets pulled away from you. So that is essentially a very high marginal tax rate. So people are effectively receiving 15 cents on the dollar for a job that they take. Now, so the question is, and I asked this for Josh, too, like, would you actually take a job if you were going to receive 10 cents on the dollar? And that seems to be a very large disincentive. What Finland is saying is like, okay, let's actually just give people money. And then when they start to get work, then that is actually added on top of it so that they actually benefit from work. And so that's really a changing of incentive. It's a removal of a harsh disincentive that exists right now. This is actually an improvement on the welfare system, and that's exactly what the Finland hypothesis is.
Josh, let me pick up on a couple of things, and both of you are putting really interesting stuff on the table here. One has to do with automation, but I'm also thinking of some of these new companies, new profitable companies that are being created, and they have, you know, 47 employees. Do we have enough, even looking into the near future, do we have enough work for people that want to work?
I think we can have enough work for people who want to work. You have some of these, you know, these big marquee companies don't have a ton of employees, but in some cases that's just because they have a lot of contractors. In the case of Uber, it is creating jobs, and self-driving cars will eventually get rid of those jobs, but not that soon. You also have sectors like healthcare and education where there's growing demand and which remain extremely labor intensive. I think the main reason that we haven't been creating enough jobs over the last 20 years has been to do with trade imbalances. Not everything is futuristic. I think that Donald Trump has been about 30% right in the way that he talks about global trade, and that because the U.S. runs this persistent trade deficit, we send money abroad for products and the money doesn't come back to buy products from us. There are shifts that we can make in policy that would adjust that, that would create new jobs and services and to some extent in manufacturing in the U.S. We're not building as many homes as we should be. If we were on a normal pace of home construction, there would be a lot more jobs in construction. So no, I don't think the economy is systematically broken in a way that can't generate enough jobs. We have sort of garden variety labor market problems that could be fixed without doing something so out of the box. And then I would note on the issue of, you know, isn't this better than a welfare program that gets taken away if you go to work? Isn't it more pro-work? It is to the extent that it is replacing those programs. But a universal basic income of $1,000 a month would cost about four times what we currently spend in total on welfare programs in the United States. So this wouldn't just be a replacement of existing programs. It would be a much larger payment that would make it possible for a lot of people to exit the workforce entirely. It wouldn't be a great existence to live on $1,000 a month. But there are a surprising number of Americans who live currently solely on programs like Social Security, disability. They have a low standard of living. They're not happy. They don't want to be living, you know, off the government. But it is possible to do. And if you wrote checks like this, more people would do it. So I think, you know, and then the other problem there is you can't get rid of all the existing welfare programs. For example, Medicaid. You can't give people cash as a substitute for health insurance because they can't go out there and effectively buy health insurance with the cash. So some of those programs you're going to be stuck with even if you create a universal basic income on top of them, and they'll still create the disincentive to work. There'll still be the issue that if you get a job, you may lose your Medicaid coverage and get health coverage that's not as good. So those problems are very real, I agree, but I don't think they can be fixed with a universal basic income.
Scott, let me go back with you with one thing that Josh just said there, which is just the high cost of something like this. How do you sell this, especially to a new Republican Congress and a new Republican president?
Yeah, there's a real misunderstanding about the costs here, because the way that you can do that, I call it the quick napkin math, is that you do the napkin math and you say, oh, well, that's like $3 trillion. And the thing is, UBI is not, we're not just printing money and just dropping everybody. The money has to come from somewhere. And because of that, people are actually giving money and getting money back at the same time. So we're looking at a net transfer. If you're familiar with the idea of a negative income tax, and this is Milton Friedman, he talked about this, and he was also for basic income. And a negative income tax is essentially you choose a point on the income line, and below that point, you're actually given you're given extra money from the government, and above that point, you pay in more. That's a negative income tax. So the way that a base income would work is essentially in the same way. It's just the money is going both ways. So like a negative income tax is like giving a base is like being given a basic income, and that money is taxed. And the basic income is you're given a basic income and your revenue is taxed. So the net transfer is actually around $900 billion. And that's before the removal of existing programs. Then you can actually focus on those programs. Like, you really don't need food stamps. You don't need EITC. And stuff like Medicaid and Medicare, yeah, we should not touch. I don't believe that we should. But we don't need to. And as soon as if we do these programs, you do it in a smart way, then we're looking at a net transfer from the top around 10% of the population to the rest of the population, mostly the bottom 60%, and that's around of a few hundred billion dollars. And that's totally raisable, and that we actually do need to raise that because capital is replacing labor. What we should do is tax capital.
Let's take a very short break. I wish I had a blackboard. Talking with Scott Sentence and Josh Sparrow about something called universal basic income. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Josh Sparrow and with Scott Santons about something called Universal Basic Income, UBI. It's an idea that's been around for a while. Excuse me. Giving everyone a flat payment, a monthly check, regardless of income, no strings attached. It is being tried on a small scale in Finland. Scott Santons is a New Orleans-based writer who's been a proponent of UBI. Josh Sparrow is senior editor at Business Insider, a critic of UBI. 1-888-477-9499, the number to join our conversation. A lot of comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Josh, I wonder whether we have to go as far away as Finland to run this experiment and whether it's actually being run in Alaska. My understanding is that every man, woman, and child living in Alaska gets money based on the oil wealth of that state. Is that a form of UBI?
It's a form of it, but the check is, I forget what it is at last count, but it's typically somewhere in the ballpark of $1,500, $2,000 a year. So it's not something that is a basic income, really. You wouldn't live off $2,000 a year. So I think, you know, that experiment, I think, has worked well as far as it goes. It's clear that people work in Alaska.
Right.
I think to some extent it's been an inducement for people to stay and live in Alaska rather than moving elsewhere. Taxes are also very low there. But, I mean, Alaska can do that because they have this enormous oil wealth beneath the ground of their state, a lot of oil per resident. So most places don't have the same natural resource bounty that allows them to do that.
But wouldn't UBI address the problem of wage stagnation, which is real, and it affects a lot of people in this country? Obviously, people that are not living on their Wall Street wealth, but wouldn't UBI affect wage stagnation, Josh?
Well, it depends what you mean by the problem. It would raise incomes for people. So to the extent that the problem with wage stagnation is that people's incomes are not rising fast enough, then yeah, it would address that problem. On the other hand, it wouldn't address the problem that people don't feel valued at work because their wages are not high enough. And it also wouldn't necessarily encourage people to work at the margin. It would raise your total income, but it wouldn't raise your income from working an additional hour. So I think the increasing inequality in the labor market would continue to widen. You would have changes to the extent that job satisfaction is linked to how much you're paid for the job. You'd have the same problem with people not feeling appreciated at work, whereas there are other policies we could do to tighten the labor market that would basically make companies compete more to hire workers. I mean, for example, the federal government is very bad at enforcing immigration law around employment and pursues policies like guest worker programs to increase the quantity of low-skill labor available in the United States. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago interviewing a roofing contractor complaining that he now has to pay roofers $20 an hour because it's harder to find immigrant roofers. It's great if roofers are paid $20 an hour or $24 an hour. There are things we could do on that margin that would actually push wages up directly that would both address the problem of stagnating incomes and address the problem of people not feeling appreciated and rewarded at work.
Scott, let me toss a couple of things back at you just from what Josh said there. What about instead of UBI, a living wage so that at least people are getting more than minimum wage, you don't have this problem of the working poor. And with UBI, the money goes to everyone. Why should a wealthy person get a check from the government?
Yeah, okay. So first of all, and this is what I find really interesting, is that the fear that people have of people not working with UBI is exactly its power. And that's what is able to, let's say, replace a minimum wage with it. So, for example, why do people accept or why would people accept a job for, let's say, $7 or $6 or $5 an hour? And so then the government comes in and says, wait a second, we need to create a floor because people are accepting so little money that we don't want that. So we set like a minimum floor and say, okay, here's $7.50, that you cannot pay anyone less than this. But a universal basic income, somebody who has $1,000 a month already, now they'll look at this market and they'll say, wait a second, I don't want to take this terrible job that I do not want to do for $7.50 an hour. But I will accept, say, $15 an hour if you offer this to me, but otherwise, no. And it's that ability to say no that actually increases worker bargaining power. And that's really what people need. That's what will raise wages at the bottom, is that people can actually have some bargaining power inherent already.
Well, let me pick up on that. But if there's someone else standing in line behind that person, if they say no, the person behind them might say yes.
And that person behind them also has a basic income. So, yeah, that's exactly it. If we want like a free market for labor, which I believe a lot of people who care about capitalism and who don't want like regulation in the markets want, then we actually need to actually give people that ability. Then they can actually have that stance and that bargaining power. And then if they still choose to do that job, then they're choosing to do it out of their own free will, and that's what they're choosing. So you can actually see a kind of a transformation of the labor market where, let's say, high-demand jobs would be a different situation than with low-demand jobs. And then also, you also get this effect where we're looking at technology matching the cost of humans. So let's say if someone who doesn't want to flip burgers, let's say, at $15 an hour, and then a machine could actually be effectively at that same cost, then the market will actually incentivize this automation, which is, again, what we want. If humans don't want to do a job because it doesn't pay enough or because they just don't want to take their basic income, then it actually incentivizes automation.
Josh, I know you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Well, these are two contradictory things that proponents of UBI say. One is that they say that it's a pro-work policy, that unlike what we do now, it will not discourage people from working. It will not push people out of the labor force. And then they turn around and say it'll push wages up because people will be able to credibly threaten to exit the labor force. So it has to be one or the other. Either it's going to increase worker bargaining power by getting some people to exit entirely. Not everybody who wasn't going to take the $7.50 job will get the $15 job in that scenario that you describe, where people are more willing to say, no, I won't take that job. I'm willing to not work at all. Some will get the higher paying job and some won't work at all. So I think, you know, to the extent that this story is correct about UBI tightening the labor supply and pushing up wages that you have to pay to get people to work, that has to be coupled with a lot of people exiting the labor force entirely, which I think would be destabilizing to society and also would, again, increase resentment because people would look around and see these people who've decided they don't need to work anymore because they collect a universal basic income and they will just sit at home and live off that.
But how – I asked this before, Josh. Hold on, Scott. But I am thinking about the working poor, and I always hate saying that because you just feel like, you know, if you're working, you shouldn't be poor. and there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement on a living wage or even raising the minimum wage except for a couple of cities and a couple of states. I mean, it still feels, Josh, as if there's a lot of income stagnation.
Well, certainly there is, and that's, you know, and I think that there are a wide variety of drivers for that and that we need to address. I mean, some of them are macroeconomic policy. We allowed the labor market to be loose for far too long. It took 7 years to get back close to full employment from the crash that we had, and more aggressive monetary and fiscal policies could have addressed that. I think there are direct things the government could do in construction and infrastructure that would have driven up employment. I think more effective enforcement of immigration law would make the labor market tighter. And then there are changes in the structure of the way companies organize with outsourcing and franchising and pushing labor off the balance sheet of big companies into the operations of subcontractors and sub-subcontractors. And there are regulatory things we could do to discourage that and basically put more responsibility in the hands of large firms for the compensation and treatment of their workers. And I think that would tend to push the share of the economy that goes to wages up like it was in the 60s and 70s. When companies had models like that. I think we've seen a past in the United States when the labor market worked well for ordinary people, and there's a lot we could do to go back toward that time. I agree that wage stagnation is a problem, but I don't think paying people to not work is the solution to wage stagnation.
Scott, let me read a comment from Chris who says, basic income will be the future with the growth of technology. Interesting, but not likely to happen. So I wonder whether you've had responses like this from others who say, yeah, it makes a lot of sense, but it's never going to happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a common response, especially when you first hear it. And even after, you know, you look into it for a bit, you're like, oh, well, that's not going to happen. But the thing is that we are looking at a transformation, and we actually have been saying it for decades. So we were talking about this earlier, about this growth of jobs. And the thing is that we have been transforming our jobs. Like, all 9 million net new jobs since 2005 have been in alternative work sectors. So this means you're looking at part-time jobs, you're looking at temporary jobs, you're looking at contract work, you're looking at gig labor, you're looking at, like, driving for Uber and such. Like, these are the new jobs that we're looking at. And the thing is that these kinds of jobs don't have the same benefits as we are used to thinking about and used to have decades ago. So these kind of new jobs that people are getting, they don't have unemployment insurance. They don't have pensions in the future. Like, they don't have any kind of protections. And so how do you do that inside this new kind of world of work that we're doing? A universal basic income very nicely actually handles that stuff and actually encourages it. It removes the friction so that people can actually move from job to job to job, or from task to task, or from job to retraining to job. Like, all those steps becomes more possible because you're not worrying about this bureaucracy. You're not worrying about means testing. It's just a so much more efficient way of going about this. And that's really the thing that we have to look at, is that we have a system designed around a way of work that we're no longer working. And so as looking to now and looking even in the future, that's going to grow, and it's not going to go away. And we just can't pretend that we're going to – that this system that we have that we built decades ago is going to work for it.
Josh, respond to Scott's comments about the new jobs, the Uber driver jobs that we see growing today, for instance.
Yeah, well – I agree that work has become less secure, but that's been a policy choice. We have allowed corporations to shed their responsibilities and then bear no legal liability. For example, you know, that if, you know, the Wendy's Corporation owns a fast food store, then they're responsible for whether the store is abiding by labor laws, immigration laws, food safety laws, et cetera. But if they franchise that operation out, then it's a franchisee who does that, and the government doesn't have the resources available to keep track of each individual franchisee. And so a lot of stuff doesn't, you know, get enforced. I don't mean to single out Wendy's. It's any restaurant with a business model like that. We could change those laws. We could hire more labor inspectors. We could the labor market could be regulated more effectively than it is, and that would improve the quality of work in the United States. So I think people sort of have this fatalistic idea about what jobs are like, both that, you know, they have jobs have to have weak protections, wages have to rise slowly, that jobs have to go away because of automation. And I just think, you know, you look back, wage work has been at the center of the American economy through the entirety of the United States. And it's how we've organized most of our lives. It's a core institution, and it's destabilizing if you say that, you know, that we're going to have a future where that's not the way things work anymore. And some people will support themselves simply by receiving a check from the government, and other people at the top of the income spectrum will develop blockbuster ideas that make them very rich, and then will tax those people to support everybody else. It's just a new untested model, and it's one that's likely to generate a lot of resentment, because in the process you're going to have an asymmetrical decline of work. You will have some people who are working a lot less. We're seeing this already. There's been a huge decline in participation in the workforce by men aged between 30 and 60, a group that ordinarily would have extremely high labor force participation. And people are upset about it. And you see all the reporting coming out of old coal mining towns in Appalachia. And it's, you know, it's both groups. You know, the people who aren't working aren't happy about it. And the people who are watching their neighbors not work and live off government benefits aren't happy about it either. They're resentful about it. And so I look at huge social changes like that, and they look destabilizing and scary to me. I would like to find the way to make the model that we've used for such a long time work. I don't believe that the model is dead yet.
And that's Josh Barrow, who joins us along with Scott Santons. We are talking about something called UBI, Universal Basic Income. Let me get some callers in the conversation. And we have Zachary from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Zachary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
My question is for Josh. So I understand that you've talked about the switch to mechanical agriculture and also how things were in the 70s with employment and wages. And I wonder how population growth affects that, because population growth is increasing, obviously, since the 70s. It's almost doubled in the world, and it might triple by the time we get to the 2050s. So I'm just wondering how those two things interact, and I'll take my answer off there.
I guess the idea of if the population is going to outstrip the number of jobs available. Josh, you want to take that?
Well, I mean, I would say the demographic situation in the United States is actually the other way. The population is aging. The fraction of the population that is of prime working age is falling. So the number of jobs that we need in order to put all those people to work is actually less daunting than it was in the past. The main driver of population growth in the United States, because our birth rate is not especially high, population growth is mostly a matter of immigration policy. And I think we actually have we can have plenty of room in the labor market for a significant amount of immigration. But if the problem is that the population is rising too fast, then we can adjust that through immigration policy by increasing or decreasing the amount of people that we admit to the United States. I don't think the demographics are a problem here. Some of the best periods for the labor market in the United States were periods of rapid population growth in the post-World War II era. It didn't seem to pose a problem for putting people to work.
Let me quote something you said, Scott. You said the greatest obstacle to human progress is the longstanding connection between work and income. We've sort of been talking about that, but flesh that out for us.
Yeah. So again, it goes to this: if we're looking at this changing of work, which we are, then it's important to actually decouple income from work. And that's the thing. The important thing to recognize is that work is not the same thing as jobs. So there's actually a whole lot of valuable work going on right now that is not being accounted for. It's been estimated that $700 billion a year of unpaid care work is going on. And so that's people doing this work for free, and it's stuff that's very meaningful to them. They feel they need to do it. But it's not considered a job. If you volunteer, that's not considered a job, but it's a very meaningful work. If you do stuff like if you work in the open source software movement, then that's actually free work, but it's not considered a job. So this idea that Josh has that people need jobs in order to have meaning, I just think is false. What people need, they need work in their lives. They need meaning in their lives. They need to feel that what they're doing actually has a purpose, that they want to get better at something. It's intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation. That's what's really important. So when we look at this future where people are less able to actually get paid for the work that they do, then that's what's so important about basic income, is that that is unconditional, that they treat that no matter what, and that enables work. It enables you to pursue the work that you want to pursue. And we see this. We see this in jumps in entrepreneurship, in places where it's been tried. Like, it's been tried in India and Namibia, and we saw that in Namibia, self-employment jumped 301%. In India, we saw that those in experimental groups were three times more likely than the control groups who didn't receive it to actually start their own businesses. Like, this is the kind of stuff that you see when you actually look at the evidence, that people actually do want to work, and money is what enables work. I mean, we know the saying that it takes money to make money. That's what basic income is, that you get those, you get that money, and that enables you to pursue that work. So when you're looking at the future, yeah, where there's less paid work, you can use that.
All right. Hold on, Scott. And Josh, go ahead. And we're almost up on a break, but go ahead, Josh, and then we'll pick up after the short break. But go ahead.
I just think that's entirely wrong. I mean, you can look at the communities in the United States where work is declining, where people can't find jobs, where you have high numbers of people collecting disability insurance. People are not happy to be liberated from work in those communities. Those communities are in a dire place. They want jobs to come back. They want to be able to support themselves. And I don't think that we're going to have a radical reconceptualization of what work is and say that what people who are not working are doing is in fact work. What we will have if we have this kind of future that Scott wants is that we'll have an increasing number of people who don't work. They'll be supported with an expensive UBI benefit that will be paid for by taxes paid broadly by people who are working, who will be resentful about it. And they won't look at them and say, oh, those people are following their passions. Those people are doing valuable work in the community. What they'll say is those people are not working. And that's going to be unhappy for the people who are paying to fund the UBI, and it's also going to be unhappy for the people who are living off of it. I think that, again, I think when you look at successful, happy communities in the United States, there are places where a lot of people work. They have work available to them. They find the work opportunities available to be well compensated. That's the future we need.
We're up on a break, and we'll be right back talking about UBI, Universal Basic Income. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Just a recap here, talking about something called Universal Basic Income. We've been referring to it as UBI. And it is an idea that's been around for a while, has been tried in small scale. In fact, it's being tried in Finland. The idea is people receive a monthly check regardless of their income, no strings attached, for the possibility of the rest of your life. Josh Barrow, senior editor of Business Insider, a critic of UBI. Scott Santens, a New Orleans-based writer who is a proponent of UBI. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. And if you're going to send us an email, don't send us like a paragraph, just a couple of sentences, and then I can get through them. You can also send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Bailey from Bucks County. Bailey, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had two quick sort of points and questions. One, I think Josh overestimates the impact of stronger immigration enforcement, and I think we're seeing that currently, both on the high and the low end. Apparently, many Western farmers are having trouble getting all their crops in because they don't have the labor forces to do it. And Americans have shown for decades that they will not do those jobs. And two, on the high end in the tech sector, they're having trouble finding engineers at a lot of these companies because our immigration policies are so tight. And I have to say, I go with Scott on the distinction between work and jobs. I did some volunteer work teaching in a prison, which I would love to do for more time, but it's volunteer and I don't get paid for it. And as it stands, I'm a full-time Uber driver who is killing his car, losing money every week by the depreciation value because I put more miles on it than I pay for with the job. So I would like to have a job that paid me a living wage. And, you know, if we look at all the states' economies where they're raising the minimum wage, most of them seem to be going gangbusters. And I think it's time for a corporate shift where perhaps we could value our human capital a little more than paper towels and toilet paper, which seems to be the current trend. Well, humans are kind of, you know, our workforce is very low on the corporate value scale, with some notable exceptions.
Sure.
But,
well,
you know, perhaps it's time for that trend to take root in America.
Well, Bailey, in many ways, you're the perfect person to call our show. Let me give Josh Barrow and then Scott Santens a chance to respond to the comment. He's an Uber driver, says he's not making a lot of money there. He volunteers, would love to do volunteer work, and I'm sure that's valuable work in a prison to have someone, you know, working with prisoners on things like literacy and things like that. Josh, it's an argument for UBI.
Well, so I'd say a couple of things. I mean, first, on the immigration side, I don't think there's such a thing as a job Americans won't do. There are jobs Americans won't do for a given wage. And so the situations that the caller describes where employers are having difficulty finding workers to fill jobs, that's a good thing. They can fill those jobs if they pay more. And that's what you see, for example, in construction. When you have a tight labor market, wages go up for low and middle skill jobs. That's exactly what we need if we want to make work pay for people. It's not just about the government legislating a wage, because that can only raise wages at the bottom of the spectrum. If we want rapidly rising wages in the middle of the spectrum, we need to create situations where, for example, software engineers have bargaining power when they go into job negotiations. The company can't just go to India and fill the job, so they need to pay more in order to fill the job. That can make work more rewarding. As for volunteer work and being compensated for that, I think volunteer work is all to the good. But again, it's a question of fiscal priorities. If you have a program like this that's going to cost trillions of dollars a year, that requires major new taxes that you have to levy to pay for it, and it competes with other things that we might like to do with government with tax money, such as creating child care and maternity leave benefits that would, again, make work better for parents, because they would be able to reasonably afford to go to work. They would not be buried in the costs of having children and work at the same time. So it's a question of priorities. Volunteer work is great, but do we really want to pay people to do that as compared to other things we might spend the money on?
Scott, what do you want to say back to Bailey? And I'm also thinking about whether if we had a more unionized workforce, would we need a UBI, a universal basic income?
Yeah, okay, so first of all, I think it's just that's a great example. I ask people a lot, like, what would you do with a basic income? Because that's really what we need to be thinking about, is if you have a basic income, if you are guaranteed $1,000 a month as your minimum income floor, then what does that enable you to do that you're currently unable to do? And there's so many great answers out there, and that's one of them, where you already have this idea of what you want to do. And it's unpaid, and that's exactly it. It's valuable work that's unpaid. So I just want to ask, like, all the listeners, like, what would you do if you had that? How would that change the way that you work? And if you can hold of it, if you can think of that, then that actually enables you to, you know, to better see this importance. Now, Josh mentioned, it's funny, he just mentioned what I said earlier about the ability to say no and the effect on wages. So, yeah, if you just pay someone more, then they'll do that work. So that's what UBI enables, is that if you can actually, if people aren't doing a job, then that job can just pay more in order to get that person to do it. And we both agree that that works. That's exactly how it works. And he also mentioned, as far as like possible programs instead, like paternity leave and things.
Right.
And the thing is that in Canada, where this was tried back in between 74 and 79 in the Delph and Mincombe experiment, that was one of the effects that was witnessed, is that new mothers, we actually used this money as effectively paid maternity leave. They said, okay, well, thank you for this cash, and I'm going to actually now stay home because I just had a kid, and this will enable me to do that. And so you don't need maternity leave if you have a basic income. You don't need minimum wage if you have a basic income. Like, you actually, this enables people to do these things on their own that we currently are trying to do in all sorts of other ways.
Bailey, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have, it looks like, Arantha joining us from Philadelphia. I'm probably mispronouncing your name, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, it's okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So actually, it was just with, I guess, the last caller, or if that was Scott. But it's really, I think UBI would be great for people, because I feel the middle class, or even people like the working poor, would have a great advantage to maybe making their own business or getting out of a rough situation that they just don't have the money to do. And then even people who, let's say, are, you know, they work every day and they can support their family, but all of a sudden, you know, like, they have to take care of their parents. And that's an expense, like, they wish they could give them better help, but it's just giving a little bit of extra money is a boost in so many ways, or even to business owners. You know, I work for two small businesses, and I consider myself working poor because I'm working bill to bill, but I think that if both of the shops I work for were able to, you know, have a little bit extra money, they would be more than happy to supply more hours, and then I could get more pay.
Well, I appreciate the call. And again, another really interesting addition to our conversation. What we hear, Josh, from our caller is that this money would give a cushion. And for those people that are living paycheck to paycheck, something happens to their car, you know, that they're in trouble. This gives them a little bit of cushion.
Well, I mean, it's obviously true that any given person that you send $12,000 a year to will appreciate receiving $12,000, and that will allow them to have a higher standard of living. But again, it's a question of the money has to come from somewhere. Scott's math on the net versus gross cost doesn't make a lot of sense. You have to look at the gross cost because, yes, some of the money will be collected in taxes from people who are also receiving these checks, but that matters because it means that every extra hour they work, they're having to pay additional taxes in order to pay for this program that sent them the check but also sends checks to lots of other people. So for those businesses, you know, maybe they'll have more money available to hire, but they'll be bearing a lot of the burden of that tax to pay for this program. Individuals will be bearing that burden as well. And to the extent that, you know, I don't think that we can collect $3 trillion a year in additional taxes on capital income, because there is the amount of capital income in the United States in a given year is only on the order of $4 or $5 trillion to begin with. But to the extent that you try to do that out of a tax on capital, that will discourage business investment, discourage job creation and growth. So it's like any government program. You have to do a cost-benefit analysis. Yes, it would be nice to receive a check for $1,000 every month, but how are we going to pay for it? And what is the thing that we do that pays for that going to – how is that going to affect our work, our businesses, our lives? And the net effect, I believe, would be significant discouragement of job creation.
Well, let me try this out on you, Josh, because we are a consumer-based economy. I think, what, about 70% of our economy relies on people spending money for services and for products. If people have, let's say, an extra $12,000 a year, won't that be good for the economy? Because they'll be spending it, especially if they're moderate or even low income.
Not necessarily, because, again, the money has to come from somewhere. And so, yes, the check will tend to increase consumption, but the thing that is done to pay for the issuance of the checks will tend to decrease consumption. And so it depends where those revenues come from. I feel like a lot of the conversations around this sort of stuff with stimulating demand feel stuck in 2009. When you're in a situation like we were in 2009, when you have mass unemployment, you have people who are simply not consuming because they don't have income right now, if you have the government borrow money and send them checks, or if you have the government tax rich people and send them checks, that will increase consumption. But that's not true at a time like now, when the economy is close to full employment and the things the government has to do to lay its hands on that money to send them out takes money away from things that would be going toward consumption and job creation. So no, I don't believe that a UBI would lead to a net increase in economic activity.
I have a bunch of comments here. I'm trying to read through them and listen. Go ahead, Scott. And let me just read through some comments. But go ahead. You comment to what Josh just said.
Yeah. So this is interesting. Is that you know, there's a multiplier effect that we know about, and that's that if you give, say, for every dollar that you give to someone who's earning over six figures, say someone who's working on Wall Street or something, then that adds 39 cents to the GDP. If you give someone in the bottom quintile that same money, if you get someone who's earning a minimum wage, then that actually adds $1.21 to the GDP. So there's a huge multiplier effect. It's three times as beneficial to the economy to give money to the bottom than it is to the top. So he's talking about the difference that would make to the economy by removing that money. And it's actually – there's a multiplier effect for doing that. And also Josh talks about this high cost and like high marginal tax rates, and you just don't require that. I've modeled this before for a basic income to see just what kind of tax rates you'd see per quintile. And you're really talking about the top 10% would need to pay about an extra top 10 or 10% in extra revenue. And the bottom 60% would see an increase. The bottom with the fourth quintile, the fourth 20%, actually seeing no net increase or decrease. So you're
those numbers are wrong.
Huge thing.
Well,
there's
on,
no
Josh.
Way that math works.
Hold on, Josh. Just finish your thoughts, Scott, and then Josh, I'll give you a chance to jump in.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing is that I've actually done the math. If you actually look at this, if you can actually fund a UBI, and this is just theoretical because I wouldn't recommend this as being the way to do it, but a 40% flat tax would work. If you use a 40% flat tax, then that actually does fund the UBI, and you actually can able to get rid of all these programs that you no longer need. That works. And if you do that, then you actually see it would effectively be giving, let's say, $12,000 to the bottom, an extra, say, $8,000 to the second 20%, and an extra $4,000 to the next 20%. So you're talking, this is because you're paying out and paying in at the same time. And you don't need as much tax as Josh believes. You just have to actually look and do the calculation.
We could argue about a 40% flat tax, but go ahead, Josh.
No, but the 40% there is the key number. I realize the tax doesn't have to be flat, but that shows you the enormous amount of revenue that's needed to pay for this. It would be equivalent to a tax that collects an extra 40 cents out of a dollar of your paycheck. And the thing is that the reason that the net numbers Scott is giving out don't work is because it's not a wash when you say we sent you this check and then we take taxes back from you, because the check is flat. The taxes come out of every paycheck and they increase with every extra hour you work. So whatever tax is levied, however we distribute it, it's at the margin. It means that, you know, when you work extra, you're paying a little, not a little more, but a lot more to pay for this very large government program. It means that your take-home pay from that extra hour of work is reduced by maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 25%, maybe it's 35%. This would be a huge disincentive to work. It would be a huge disincentive for companies to create jobs, just because it's trivially true to say, well, yeah, we collect this tax money, but we send it back out. That's true of any government program. It gets spent on something. But the incentive effects on work are at the margin. It's how much more tax will you pay for the extra hour that you work? And this created big disincentive to work in jobs wherever it is on the income spectrum that you choose to levy this. And it's so big that you can't just put it all at the top.
Let me read some comments here. One from Janice. I like this concept. Find myself wondering, wouldn't landlords just raise the rents and eat up all that money? An email from Mike. UBI have begun to adopt the term neo-Marxism. Does this threaten to throw some sand in the transmission, particularly in a Trumpian USA? A tweet from Eric, UBI wouldn't raise wages only if a lot of people withdraw from the labor force. It would require only that they can credibly threaten to. An email from Roy, how ironic, we already have UBI for the 1%. Do you agree with that, Scott?
Yeah, we do already have UBI for the 1%. And the funny thing, too, is we actually give them so much as far as, say, tax expenditures. We, you know, the whole mortgage interest rate deduction is something that really mostly benefits the top. If you look at capital income, and this is, you know, this is income, it's in the form of dividends being earned, and this is something that the rich do, and we don't worry about the rich giving a dividend. They receive a dividend for no work, having this, you know, just owning stock, and they do fine with that. They don't have a loss of meaning for this. And this is actually what gets really interesting, is that all of the U.S. are actually stockholders. Every citizen of the U.S. is a stockholder. Because we've actually, our taxes are actually funding the base technology, the base research that goes into the technologies like self-driving cars, like, you know, all this technology that we have into automation. This is stuff is being funded by tax dollars that from decades ago.
Well, you know,
and so why should we not receive a dividend on these investments?
Okay. And I'm saying this only because I'm looking at the clock, and I want to give you, Josh, a chance to respond to that 1% comment.
Well, I don't think that capital income constitutes a dividend, a UBI for the 1%. Now, there are different kinds of capital income. The most sympathetic example that UBI proponents point to is natural resources, which is basically like, why don't we have the Alaska model where the natural resources are owned by the whole population and the profits from them shared equally. And I think that approach is fine, although you have to have some sort of transition. You have companies that invested in mineral rights in various places. The problem is that most capital is not like mineral rights. It's things like technologies that cost money to develop. The capital has to be created. It's not just found in the ground. And if you try to tax away all the income from that, then people won't make investments in the sorts of new technologies that grow the economy and improve our standards of living. So you can't just say, here's all this capital income, let's tax all of it away. You could tax some of it away, especially to do with things like oil and gas, but that's not most of the capital in the economy.
Well, we did not settle the argument, but we had a really interesting conversation. Josh Barrow, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
Senior editor at Business Insider, Scott Santons, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a writer based in New Orleans. And we appreciate all that interest, those calls, those comments as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, you can carry on the Facebook page conversation that we started yesterday. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.